You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
I will smash your face into a jelly!
Now, I should say that when you do a UFO investigation, you never know what you're going to get into. In the McMinnville photograph case, one of the things I wanted to know about was the size, the diameter of the wires that go over the that appear at the top of the picture.
Yeah.
Well, how do you figure that out? I wanted to figure out the size. I wanted to know what the size of the wires was so I could use the photogrammetric method of calculating the distance of the camera from the wires. So I had to make a study of those wires. I had to look up an old electronics book and find out what the diameter of the old-fashioned type of insulation on 14-gauge or something like that, copper wire.
Yeah, this is a serious business. Yeah, wow.
You know, who would think that this isn't related to UFOs?
Exactly.
There were numerous other aspects that you get into, and in the New Zealand case, there are all sorts of things that, because the New Zealand case, the New Zealand sightings that I was investigated took place late at night in the early morning of December 31st, 1978. They involved six witnesses. Let's see, what am I saying? One, two, three, four, five. Yeah, six witnesses. Well, four different witnesses. And actually, pilot, co-pilot, and two reporters that were involved as eyeball witnesses. And then there was a Wellington Air Traffic Control Center guy watching the screen on the radar, and the radar tape, which allowed us to reconstruct this whole trip. And then there was a tape recording made on the plane by the reporter who happened to be on the plane, as I said, trying to do a little story on previous sightings.
Yeah.
And he got caught in the middle of something that changed his life. At any rate, all sorts of aspects of this came in, the radar and cameraman with a 16mm color movie that I had to analyze, thousands of frames of information, and of course, just playing, interviewing the witnesses. I actually flew to New Zealand and Australia to interview all the witnesses myself. So anyway, I had written a paper based on this that says essentially that there was something real there. And then Phil contacted me about a year later and started asking questions about the technical details. And over the next, over the next 2 years roughly, we probably exchanged something like 1,500 or more pages, single-spaced, of text. Questions by him. Answers by me, questions by him, answers by me. Sometimes I asked him questions and he gave answers. It really was a very finely ground up case, you might say, by the time we got finished with it.
Indeed, yeah.
And he wrote about it in his book, his third book, UFOs the Public Deceived, which is aptly named because he deceived the public in his book. And in particular, in the New Zealand case, there was one section of this film which shows a flashing light that flashes from white, large white images to small, dim orange and red images. The orange and red images, that's a little triangle with an orange dot up above two red dots that make a triangle shape. And the white images have no trace of red in them, but they're much bigger. They're like overexposed white images. And this, there was 30 cycles, the cameraman got 30 cycles, I think it was, and about 30, one cycle per second starting, well, the camera was running at 10 frames a second, and it took about 10 frames to complete a cycle from maximum brilliance to minimum brilliance and back to maximum again. This is just one part of the New Zealand sighting case, but it's perhaps the most interesting part from the point of view of Phil's handling of it. Phil wrote in his book that the images are hot dog shaped, that is often bent curves, and of course the cameraman was holding the camera on his shoulder on a moving airplane.
Yeah.
And so naturally the image of some light way out there in space, which by the way apparently was picked up by Wellington radar and seen by the pilot and co-pilot and a reporter, this light out there was bouncing around in the film, and so you see it moving around in the film. And when you have an exposure time and some object moving during the exposure time, it leaves a trail.
Yeah.
It elongates the image. So you've got these various elongated images, various lengths and various shapes and so on. And Phil decided that Oh, he still knew one thing that I had told him, which was on the top of the airplane, there was a red rotating beacon. This is a typical thing for an aircraft to have.
Yeah.
And the beacon rotates at one cycle per second. Once every second, you get a red shot, a shot of red in your eye, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And that was essentially the same rate that we were getting for this flashing light that was changing from white to red, white, bright white to dim red orange. Well, Phil conceived of a method whereby the cameraman could stand inside the cockpit and film the light on top of the aircraft. Now, he had already filmed the light on top of the aircraft before the airplane even took off. He was standing on the tarmac with his camera and running his camera in, he said, by taking film of the airplane before it even took off. And his film shows the red rotating beacon on the top, and when the red rotating beacon is pointed right at the camera, the image is a yellow dot in the center, a yellow disc in the center with a red fringe around the outside. The red fringe around the outside tells you there's red light. When the light is dim, pointing in the other direction, then you just get a dim red image. So anyway, Phil's claim was that light from this red beacon was bouncing off the rotating propellers and into the camera lens, into the cameraman's lens. That would mean that the cameraman was not looking in the direction ahead of the airplane where this thing was spotted, but he had to be looking sideways, right in front of the co-pilot, really, to be able to be pointing his camera towards the propeller.
Yeah.
So Phil invents this scenario where the cameraman is looking to the right, looking at the propeller, filming the red light reflected off the propeller. And Phil argues that the craziness of the image shapes and so on was due to the fact that there was no synchronization between the propellers and the frame rate of the camera. If you read his article and you know nothing about the case at all except what he wrote, this may sound plausible as an explanation for this flashing light. What the reader doesn't know is that I proved to Phil that it was physically impossible, optically physically impossible for that to be true. And the clue was in these pictures that the cameraman took before the plane even took off. Remember, I said that the flashing light images run from very bright, large, white, overexposed with no red fringe at all, just a white image,
yeah,
to a dim triangle of red and orange. The big white images by themselves are just plain white, overexposed, maybe with a trace of orange or yellow, but there isn't any red. And so the cameraman could not have been filming the red beacon, even reflected off the propellers, because if he had been, the exposed images, overexposed images, would have had red around them on the outside.
So even though you explained all this to him, he just went ahead with his own sort of...
Absolutely.
Interesting.
I mean, that was just Phil doing his dyed-in-the-wool skeptic.
Yeah. Now you
maybe he didn't believe what I told him, but I was honest with him. And in terms of all my analysis that I did for him, there were numerous cases where he would propose an explanation for some particular part of the sighting. And that would mean that I would have to check out his explanation and see whether it made any sense or not. And this has to be one of the longest correspondences, certainly one of the longest correspondences on a UFO case, maybe one of the longest correspondences in history on some particular complex of rare phenomena, shall we say.
Sounds like a real cat.
The fact that he was willing to put that into his book, even though I had told him that it was wrong, the physics matter, and there's absolutely no way that he could have gotten a white overexposed image by filming red light reflected off the propeller. Phil went ahead and published it anyway. That's why I say his book is aptly named UFOs the Public Deceived.
Exactly, yeah. Now, you've talked about a lot of your research here into the photos and everything. Now, what do you think of this whole, the way things have changed now? We're in the digital age, and it seems like any photos of UFOs always now have this, you know, shadow of suspicion cast over them because the ability to tinker with photos is so easy for, you know, an armchair hoaxer or, you know, maniac or skeptic or whatever.
Yeah, but this has always been true. A photo a UFO does not make. You've got to have the background. Now, it is possible for a dedicated hoaxer to create a context for the photograph that is a story behind it.
Yeah.
Which makes sense in terms of the photograph, and therefore you hoax the whole thing. In the McMinnville case, for example, you have the testimony of the witnesses taken several different times by different people over the years And the fact that I personally talked to Mrs. Trent, a female witness, 24 times over a year, over a couple of years. And she was consistent with me. You have to have the background. I could not prove that the Trent photo was real just by the photo itself. I would have to admit that they could have been lucky and hoaxed it. For example, you have overhead wires, that is wires that appear at the top of the picture. If they were suspending the model from the wires, then they were stupid to show the wires. But anyway, the Trents weren't that smart. So let's suppose that there was a string hanging this model from the wire. It had to be thin enough so that you could strong enough to hold the model, but thin enough so it wouldn't show up on the film.
Yeah.
There has, of course, been numerous examinations of the original negatives looking for that incriminating thread. No one has found it. That doesn't mean that there's nothing there. If they picked a thread with the same color as the background color, there'd be no contrast between the thread and the background sky, and there'd be no way you could see it. You only see things because of contrast. As a matter of fact, all of life is just contrast. If everything were the same, boy, would it be boring.
That's deep. Yeah, I like that.
So anyway, the point I'm making is, yeah, it's true that it's easy to come up with faked photographs, but you've also got to fake a story and make it stick. And it has to stick under Well, another thing is, the closer you get to having a, quote, real UFO being coming out of a particular case, look at it like this. You begin the investigation to find out if something is real. You're taking a series of steps towards a conclusion, right?
Yeah.
Imagine you're walking up a hill.
Mm-hmm.
This hill gets steeper and steeper as you walk. So you go along a certain way, and things seem to be convincing so far, and then you take another step, ask another question about the case, and it's kind of hard to generalize because each case is different. But the closer you get towards a conclusion of anomalous, the harder it is to take the next step.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And you can never actually get to the top of the mountain because
You could in principle get there. There might be some case that is so good that no matter how you beat on it, it doesn't fall apart.
That's true, I suppose. Yeah, that's true.
That is the holy grail of ufology, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah.
You can look at all sorts of cases and ask, do they meet that criterion? One of them, which is going to be in Leslie Keene's new book, UFOs, the Government, and whatever, I forget it, the total title. I suppose you're aware it's
yes.
coming.
Oh, yeah.
The JAL 1628, the Alaskan jumbo jet 747 that flew over Alaska, heading southward, southwestward over Alaska, and had the crew had sightings as they went along, and I wrote the largest detailed, most detailed analysis of that whole case. It's been made. Publicized recently in the last 10 years by John Callahan, who was in charge of the investigation, the FAA investigation, which lasted a day or two, I guess. I was able to do complete analysis of that because I was given documentation and allowed me to reconstruct the airplane track and listen to the audio tape and reconstruct it. I published the whole thing in the IUR 1980s. In that particular case, and Phil figures into this as well, that particular case essentially began with two objects appearing right in front of the jumbo jet as they flew along. The pilot said he felt heat on his face. There seemed to be collections of flashing lights or exhaust ports or something like that on two objects that at first appeared one up above the other, if I recall correctly, and stayed that way for a couple of minutes, traveling, and they just appeared in front of the airplane that was doing 600 and some miles an hour.
Yeah.
And then they suddenly reoriented to be side by side, and these objects are rather complex. The pictures that the pilot drew of these objects is a rather complex collection of what he thought might be exhaust ports or something like that, but he wasn't really sure. And things developed as he went along his track. He's heading from the northeastern corner of Alaska down towards Anchorage, or towards Fairbanks, and then down south to Anchorage. As things developed as they went along, these objects first appeared one above the other for a couple of minutes, and then side by side for maybe 10 minutes, and then they suddenly disappeared. And the pilot looked around, and he saw off to the left, saw a glow. He turned on his airplane radar, got a big radar target reflection from that direction. Then it sort of drops back, and he's the only person who now can see anything. And he looks, as he approaches Fairbanks, he looks behind to the left, out his pilot window, he's looking to the left, and he sees what he calls a silhouette of a gigantic spaceship.
Oh, boy.
That's all history of this particular case.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very well documented. Yeah.
And you can see, again, this is something you can read on my website, my complete report on it, which is tons more complete than anything the FAA did.
Yeah, that's not surprising.
That happened in November of 1986. The FAA said they were going to investigate starting early January of 1987. In March of 1987, March 5th of 1987, they presented their final report on the case. The final report, well, I should jump back a little bit before. During the sighting itself, ground radar was involved. Ground radar, Anchorage Air Force Base, Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah.
And Elmendorf Air Force Base, which is also at Anchorage, near Anchorage, Alaska. This was either one radar being operated by two people or two separate radars. I think it's one radar that's got two operators. In any case, there was at least one point where the Elmendorf Air Force Base operator thought that the plane had some object behind it. And the Air Route Traffic Control Center guy told the airplane about this radar contact. And so when the Japanese crew finally got to Tokyo, and over the next few weeks, they told the buddies that this had happened and radar had been involved, and that story got back to American reporter in Japan, and he called up Anchorage and asked if that happened, and Anchorage public information officer said yes, it did happen, and so he wrote a story about it, and the excrement started to fly, and that's when it hit the fan, and the FAA said, well, we better investigate because radar was involved. So now 3 months later in March, they say, well, it was all a radar mistake, and they didn't say a thing about the visible sightings. The visual sightings were completely ignored by the FAA. Well, now, several weeks earlier, PSYCOP, Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, came up with their solution. Their solution was, of course, based on what Phil Klass had said, and he based his analysis totally on the transcript of the tape without knowing exactly where the airplane was flying. My investigation, I determined exactly how the airplane was flying, minute by minute, so I knew which direction the airplane was looking. But Phil didn't know which direction the airplane was looking. And so PSYCOP presented their official explanation based on what Phil Klass concluded, that there really were two extraterrestrial objects involved with this sighting, Mars and Jupiter.
Oh, man.
And if you look at it, Mars and Jupiter were to the left of where the plane's heading was. They were up there. However, to go from one above the other to side by side, Mars and Jupiter would have a tough time pulling off that reorientation in a matter of a few seconds.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the most obvious parts of the sighting was that it was one above the other and then side by side. The objects just sort of switched their orientation.
Yeah.
How long can you be on that? This is where you're walking along this ladder or climbing up the mountain towards proving something. You got three guys there. Could they all be wrong? The objects were side by side and then suddenly are one above the other and then side by side. This doesn't even ask you how accurate could they be in describing the objects. It's just how accurate do you think they are in describing how the objects were oriented.
Exactly, exactly. Now, we're at almost 90 minutes. Can you go a little bit longer? I got a few more questions for you. I won't keep you too much longer, I promise.
You stay all night if you want.
All right. Well, don't tell me that. We may be. well, I want to also touch on some other aspects of your amazingly rich career here. Now, I was surprised to find out that you had some interaction with Rick Doty in the 1980s. And, of course, he's a pretty infamous figure in the world of ufology. So I guess talk about, you know, what your take on that whole thing was as far as him, you know, seeding troublesome information, I guess you could say, to the UFO community.
My interaction with him was based on the document obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, which was a report of a landing at near Kirtland Air Force Base, a UFO landing near Kirtland Air Force Base. Again, this is something you can read about on my website. Look up the paper entitled Welcome to the Cosmic Watergate.
Okay.
What I call a Kirtland Landing document.
Yeah.
Is featured in there. The reason I got involved with Doty was because he was the person who had written this document, which said essentially that guards at the Manzano weapons storage area and another guard in the Sandia laboratory area had seen a strange object flying around the area one night in August of 1980.
Yeah.
There had, in this document, talks about some other sightings as well, but the key one was the one of August something or other, I forget the date, 1980.
I think it was 1980, yeah.
You can read that document and find out all about it, but basically some object was making zigzag maneuvers east of the Manzano weapons storage area. That was Manzano weapons storage area. It was where they had taken a small chain of mountains and put a great big double fence around it, drilled holes in it, stored nuclear weapons there.
Yeah.
And the guards traveled around this 24/7. And so one night they're traveling along and they see this thing going back and forth, and all of a sudden it drops down behind another little mountain that's east of them. And shortly after that, a Sandia guard who's driving along in a jeep comes up to a what he calls an alarmed structure. That is a building which has got a fence around it. And inside the fence is this bright object. So he takes his gun out of the, with him and starts to walk towards it. Oh, he couldn't communicate. All of a sudden, he lost communications with headquarters. Oh, it was only like 4 miles away. He lost communication with headquarters, so he takes his gun and starts walking towards this bright object, which suddenly zipped upwards. And the story of that in the document says that the witness says it wasn't a helicopter, and the witness says was a helicopter mechanic. So you're so supposed to assume that because he was a helicopter mechanic, he knows something about what helicopters are like, what they sound like, what they can do, and so on.
Yeah.
The guards at the Manzano weapons storage area had seen this light drop down behind the mountain, and then sometime later, they see the same light go zipping upwards at a high altitude and disappear. So it sounds like multiple witness UFO sighting, which would happen in 1980. Bill Moore got a hold of the document in December of 1980, I think. I'm not sure exactly. It was the summer of 1980 it was written. There were other things that happened with a guy by the name of Benowitz in the fall of 1980, which we won't go into because that gets another complete story. But at any rate, in 1985, I think it was, I happened to be on business, a business trip for the Navy, attending a meeting at Kirtland Air Force Base, where Doty was stationed. And so I decided to see if I could get any further information on this case. I figured there should be a much more detailed story about what happened.
Yeah.
Just the little one document that was available. So I just dropped in on him, so to speak. I found out where the Air Force Office of Special Investigations headquarters was and walked in and asked if Doty was there. And the security guard said no, he wasn't. He'd be back after lunch, to come back then. And so I left and then come back later and said I was here to see Doty. And he was gentlemanly about it. He didn't turn me away. Took me into his office. I stuck the piece of paper in front of him, said, did you write this? And he admitted that he did. And in the course of the conversation, he led me to believe, what he said led me to believe, maybe erroneously, but what he said seemed to me that there were other documents that one could get on this particular case.
Yeah.
Now, to be accurate about this, there were other documents, but they had to do with the Benowitz stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was all tied in together.
Yeah.
I was interested in this particular landing document, the landing case. Were there more documents on that? Anyway, I went back home, had some further correspondence with Doty about this, but then I wrote the Freedom of Information Act, and I said, I want all copies of all the documents associated with this particular case. And what they sent me was the document that I had already, plus the Benowitz documents, which I also had already. So there was nothing new. So I wrote back to him saying, wait a minute, Doty implied to me that there was more stuff. And basically over a series of months, I got Doty into trouble with the AFOSI, Freedom of Information Act guy, by arguing that there should be more stuff available, and apparently they eventually brought Doty in and questioned him really what was going on.
What do you think was going on? I mean, and to couple that, what was your reaction when everything came out about what Rick Doty was really up to?
Yeah, well, that all came out a long time after my involvement, and my involvement really just centered on this one event.
Yeah.
Trying to get further information on that. I have not had any correspondence to speak of with Doty since 1986 or 7 or whatever.
Do you think he was trying to get his hooks into you?
He wasn't trying to get anything out. He didn't give me that impression.
Okay.
He never told me anything.
Yeah.
Unlike Bill Moore, who's claiming that Doty was a major source of information.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Do you think?
Bill Moore, by the way, had investigated this landing several years before I got involved with it. And he had tried to talk to some of the witnesses. I wanted to get to talk to the witnesses too, but they wouldn't let me. Wouldn't get the first base on that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to say.
As far as Doty's further activities are concerned, I've read about them. As I said, though, I have not been involved, and maybe just as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, well, that's what I was kind of trying to ask you. It sounds like he was trying to bait you, maybe with something. Maybe he was trying to rope you into something. That's just seemed the impression I got from what you just described, as far as the meeting went.
Well,
but it's all supposition, I suppose, right?
The implication it gave me the implication that there were other documents that I should write for them.
Huh.
I did.
Oh, weird.
And the only thing that I got was this stuff having to do with Benowitz, which is not what I was interested in.
Yeah.
And then, as I said, it seemed like I got Doty into trouble. Again, you can read this whole thing on my webpage.
Absolutely, yeah. Brumac 8K, number 8K.
Number 8, letter K, right.
That's right, .com. We'll have links all over the place for it anyway. All right, now, speaking of documents and stuff, as you said earlier, you're pretty well known for getting this just huge amount of UFO files from the FBI. But in the ensuing years, I guess, what's your impression of how, you know, the FOIA has evolved and, you know, the quality of materials that's been received, not just from the U.S. government, but also, you know, how we're having these file dumps from world governments? Is it getting to the point now we're just getting overwhelmed with documents to the point where we don't really need them anymore, I guess? Do you know what I mean?
Well, and when this major document search began was, of course, there have always been, I guess, document searches of some sort or other.
Mm-hmm.
Some Project Blue Book files were released in the 1960s. The Conant study released the so-called Robertson Panel Report for the first time. You could read basically the whole thing. But it wasn't until 1975, when the Freedom of Information Act was released, that things really began to roll. In 1976, the Air Force put Project Blue Book files. Remember, Project Blue Book closed in 69. It was decided that rather than destroy everything, they would put it all on microfilm.
Yeah.
I think the documents still exist at Maxwell Air Force Base or someplace or other. But what you have access to is microfilm versions of stuff. And the microfilm became available in 1975, I think it was. And I started going to the National Archives. I was living in Washington, just outside Washington, D.C. It wasn't that tough to go down to the National Archives, spend a few hours. That was back in the old days when things were more or less easy to do.
Yeah.
You could walk back into the roll. into the aisles of microfilm up the wazoo, and there were the 92 rolls of Blue Book microfilm standing on the shelves just waiting for somebody to look. Well, there's 100,000 pages there, and you can go blind cranking from one to the next. You're supposed to have help by virtue of an index, the opening index of the microfilm file, the first roll, lists every case, 13,000 or some number like that. And you have to then go to the roll where that case is and search until you find it.
Yeah.
If you're looking for a particular case. And then the cases aren't all filed, and some are misfiled, and there's weird things. And one of them, the Rogue River sighting case that I like a lot, was buried in there by being split into pieces and so on. But anyway, I wrote for I was doing the McMinnville photograph investigation. Mrs. Trent had told me that 2 weeks or something after their photos had been published, an FBI man had come to their house and searched it. So I wrote to the FBI asking if they had any records on Paul Trent. And I said, as an aside, oh, by the way, if you have anything else, please let me know. I didn't expect to get anything because nobody had ever said that the FBI was collecting UFO sightings.
Yeah.
And even Ruppelt, Captain Edward Ruppelt, who I mentioned earlier in his book, The UFO, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, in that he said that the FBI had not been interested in the subject. So I didn't expect to get anything. I wrote to the, when I wrote in 1970, fall of 76, I got back a letter saying they were supposed to respond within 10 days. So I got back a letter saying your request is number 37,256 or some big number like that. So I figured by the year 2010, I might hear something. Instead, it was, May, I think, of 1977 that I got a phone call from a very surprised FBI agent. Who says, I dug up over 1,000 pages of stuff. I had no idea that the FBI did anything on this subject. And he said he'd be willing to pick out the what he figured were the best pages and send them to me. That was back in the days when it cost money per page.
Yeah.
So I was fine, 416 pages or something he copied, and I paid $30 or $40 or whatever it was. Turned out that there were actually 1,600 pages. And it's now on, for the last 10 years or so, it's been on the Internet. As 16 PDF files, I think, whatever you can download.
No, but do you think that the power of these files has diminished over the years since there's been so many? And you know, it sounds like back then it was quite a boon for you to find out this information.
Sure,
now they're covering their tracks a little better.
What then was, it was old knowledge that was new information.
Yeah.
Now it's old knowledge that's old information because it's been around for so long. Nevertheless, people are still not thoroughly familiar with what's in the documents. In the FBI documents, there's a couple of documents that say, written in 1952, that say the top-level Air Force people are seriously considering interplanetary spaceships. They told that to the FBI, but they wouldn't tell that to the general public. And you can read about it in my book, UFOs, the UFO-FBI Connection. Also, I think I got something about it on the website. But, you know, after the FBI... Then in December of 1978, you had the CIA that had been sued. Initially, the CIA said they had only the Robertson panel report. Then under a search, they came up with 900 and some pages of stuff that was releasable under the Freedom of Information Act request. The NSA ultimately coughed up some documents. And then in the middle 80s, the Air Force, well, these agencies are continually going through declassification procedures.
Yeah.
And so just under normal declassification, they came up with a declassification of Air Force intelligence files in the middle 80s, and we got more information coming out about what happened in the 1947, 48, 49 time frame. They're getting more and more information about what happened early on. So now we could write a better history. That's why my history, the UFO-FBI Connection, for example, is a better history than could have been written even in 1977. I got the FBI documents. I nearly needed a whole bunch of Air Force documents to set the FBI documents in their context. The documents have shown, in general, that there was interest in keeping track of this situation. Although there's no smoking gun in the documents. That is, there's nothing that says at a particular place at a particular time there was a piece of something or other. Or that General so-and-so went on record as saying that such and such a UFO sighting actually involved an extraterrestrial spaceship. You won't find something like that.
Yeah.
But you did find the FBI file about the interplanetary visitors idea. Was even that was sort of like in the extreme, and they would have told the FBI only because the FBI was acting like a black hole. No one ever expected that the Freedom of Information Act would uncover those documents.
Yeah, exactly.
But it did. And so anyway, most of the document releases were up through the early 1990s, and by that, after that, they sort of fall off. In the United States, people have complain, you know, hearing about all Spain and France and England and Australia and New Zealand and so on releasing documents, and they're saying, why don't they release documents in the United States? Well, the answer is they released stuff in the United States, probably released all they're going to. No, there are very few formerly top secret documents that have been declassified. And if this subject is really as important as we think it is, it's in the top secret world that it would reside. And they're not releasing top secret stuff.
Yeah.
So don't hold your breath. One question always is, what's this all about disclosure? When are they going to disclose? My feeling for years has been Uncle Sam's never going to admit to it until it's proven already. Then Uncle Sam will say, oh, well, we knew about it all along.
To sort of head towards the close here, you know, you've been looking at this phenomenon for 40 years. In your learned opinion, what do you think is really going on here with UFOs, and do you think we're ever really going to find out the answer, whether it's through sheer science or via, you know, some kind of government disclosure or an accidental disclosure or intentional disclosure via whomever is behind the UFOs, if you will? So that's sort of a large question, but I'm hoping that, you know, you'll have a wizened answer for us on that.
Yeah, I suppose if we ever find the answer, I suppose we probably will. We'll live long enough. But there's certainly a lot of people who think they have the answer right now. A lot of people who are speculating. There are people who admit they're speculating and people who don't admit they're speculating and claim they know the answer. As for me, I wouldn't claim that I know what's going on, but I know something is going on. Even conventional science doesn't even go that far. They think it's all misidentifications, hoaxes, and delusions. And I think there's something really out there. But where they came from, what they're doing, why they're doing it, I don't know. I could offer speculations along with everybody else, but I don't know if that's going to do us any particular good. There's a group of people who are trying to do so-called exopolitics, which I think is probably something is needed in the form of some form of exopolitics, but not necessarily the way it's being practiced at the present time under the assumption that the guys upstairs are all good guys.
Yeah.
We don't really know. We can assume that they're doing whatever they want to do, and not too worried about the impact on us. But obviously, they're not being totally covert with what they're doing, otherwise there wouldn't be any sightings at all.
That's true, yep, absolutely.
So maybe the best guess that I can make is this is part of a learning program or an acclimation program. And after we're thoroughly acclimated to their presence, whatever that means, maybe then we'll know what the answer is.
Are you hopeful to see it in your lifetime, or do you think this is something that's going to last another three or four generations?
We have to know whether we face love, hate, or indifference.
I see what you're saying, yeah. Well, yeah, it's still, that's the $65,000 question, or however you say it.
Yeah, $65 billion.
There you go,
or
exactly.
Maybe trillion. Getting close to the national debt.
Well, having been in this 40 years, are you happy that you've spent so long in this, or do you look back and say, shit, I wish I never went to that conference from NICAP back in the late 60s?
No, I don't think I ever said I wish I hadn't gotten involved in it. There may be other things that I wish I hadn't done or wasted time on, specific cases or something like that.
But, yeah.
As far as getting into it or out of it, no, I haven't. haven't even contemplated what my life would be like if I hadn't gotten involved.
Interesting. Okay. Well, as we said, you've written countless articles. You've made just tons of speaking appearances, and you've got the 5 books: UFO FBI Connection, UFOs Are Real, Here's the Proof, Could UFOs Be Real, and Melbourne Episode, Case Study of a Missing Pilot.
An Abduction in My Life.
There you go, An Abduction in My Life. Actually, looking at the titles of your books, I did want to ask you, you wrote Could UFOs Be Real in 1991, and then you followed that up with UFOs Are Real, Here's the Proof. So I found that kind of interesting. Did you,
Well, about the book, Could UFOs Be Real, is really...
The answer is yes,
supposed to be an educational book. I guess I wrote it. It was something that, so far as I know, was never widely published. The guy who was promoting that book, I don't think he ever got anywhere. There have been things on the internet available for example, from Amazon that surprised me. Things that I never intended to be books per se.
Yeah.
That turn out to be stuff. You know, the UFO FBI Connection, they'll sell for $200 or something nowadays.
Oh, wow.
Books that are out of print. The Abduction of My Life book is not out of print in the sense that I've got a bunch of clean copies of them.
Yeah.
But nobody knows it, I guess, so nobody asked me for them.
Until now.
It's mentioned on my website.
Oh.
So you can read some stuff about the books there.
Okay. And so what do you have cooking, for over the next few years? What do you have planned? You got any new books in mind, or what are you working on?
Well, probably just more of the same, case analysis and keeping up with the field. I have thought about writing, I could take all my case analyses, for example, put them into a big compilation, I suppose. But I don't know if anybody would really... care, and a lot of that stuff's already on the internet. You get it for nothing. Why sell it as a book?
Now, well, you said keeping up with the field. Now, with the risk of getting you, at the risk of pushing the snowball down the hill on another lengthy answer, because I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but, you've seen this thing grow and change since the late 1960s. Are you happy with the way it's turned out? Or do you think it could be better? Do you wish that you followed you would go in a different direction or try something different or stop getting involved in this conspiracy element of it? I mean, what are your thoughts on the way the field has changed over the last 40 years?
Well, 40 years ago, we expected the answer would be right around the corner, and it's been a long corner, and we're still turning. It's becoming a 4th, 5th, or 6th dimensional corner, I guess. I'm not really sure. The way it's changed, it's gotten... probably a lot more complex, and you have people coming into the field that don't really have the grounding and the history that you used to have.
Yeah.
You have to read a bunch of books nowadays in order to understand what happened in the first 10 years. As a matter of fact, I've often argued if we knew really what happened in the first 5 years, we'd have the answer to the question. But the government prevented us from learning a lot of stuff that was known within the first 5 years. And established the tradition that there was nothing to it, so the scientists basically said, why should we pay any attention to UFOs? And we're still stuck in that tradition. We're trying to get to the proof somehow that there really is something going on, that a proof that is convincing to the scientific community.
Yeah, yeah.
Failing that proof, you just have a bunch of people running around speculating on what's going on, some of them scientists, some of them not. Some speculations being reasonable, many of them not, I think. There's just a wider scope of things moving in ufology now than there were 40 years ago. And, of course, you have an extreme increase in information transfer rate. I mentioned earlier in this discussion that one of the cases I looked at years ago in the early 70s, it took weeks before we found out about it. Nowadays, you find out the next day.
Yeah.
Almost no matter where it is in the world.
Yeah, or in hours.
Somebody posts on the internet that they just saw something, and you know it within minutes.
Yeah, it's quite a remarkable change in the way things have been. And
it takes hours just to keep up with Facebook and in my email.
I can't imagine you on Facebook, but I will take your word for it.
Well, you can look me up.
All right. Well, Dr. Bruce Maccabee, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, giving us so much time, some extra time here. You've just had such a remarkable career, and I feel like we've really only scratched the surface, but you've given us a really amazing look at the sites and the cases and the personalities and the changes in the field that you've seen over the last 40 years. A really invaluable amount of insight here in the last hour and a half plus. And I really can't thank you enough. I'm sure this interview will be listened to and enjoyed by people for years and years to come, and will provide a wealth of information for future students of the UFO phenomenon. As I said, you're a legend in the field. It's really been an honor to get you on the program here and have the chance to examine your remarkable career. So thank you so much. I wish you the best of luck in your continued work, and look forward to reading more articles from you, and hopefully maybe another book someday, or just catching you at a speaking engagement at one of these conferences in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a delight.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 5. Big, big, super huge thanks to one of the true luminaries in the world of ufology, Dr. Bruce Maccabee, for coming on the show, and as you heard, giving us so much additional time. Of course, you can find out more from him at his website, www.brumac.8k.com. That's brumac.8k.com. Check it out. Moving right along now, even though we're kind of behind the times here on getting the episode out to folks, I do want to do some listener email, because this is, as I noted at the beginning of the show, episode number 2 of the final 4 of season 5, and I definitely won't be doing any listener feedback on the final episode. So we've only got 2 more chances to do listener feedback, and I want to make the most of those opportunities. So let's dive into the BOA Audio Listener Feedback Mailbag. I picked out 4 here for this week's segment. The first one comes from Mike in Minneapolis. Here's what he has to say. Thank you for all the awesome BOA podcasts and the excellent website. I've been listening to BOA Audio and reading the site for a while now, and have finally got around to sending you some much-deserved dough through PayPal. A suggestion for an excellent show for you to discuss on the podcast is the Fox TV show Fringe. The show is an awesome mix of weird fringe science and interesting characters. John Noble as Dr. Walter Bishop is the best mad scientist on TV ever. The more I see of this show, the more I love it. Also, a suggestion for a guest on BOA Audio is to have Linda Moulton Howe back on the show. She's an excellent, fascinating guest. I love listening to her talk about UFOs, animal mutilations, crop circles, all very interesting stuff. She is one smart person who really knows her stuff. Thanks again for all the excellent audio and website content. I hope you will keep it up for many years to come. Signed, another, in parentheses, Mike from Minneapolis. Wow, bunch of different stuff there to respond to. First of all, thank you, Mike. I echo your hopes for many more years to come of BOA Audio and BOA in general. I want to thank you heartily for your donation to Banal of America. I really appreciate it. I'm going to be hitting people hard here as we close out another rousing season of Banal of America Audio, so allow me to thank you since you have made a preemptive donation. It's very much appreciated, and it will go a long way to helping us pay the bills that have accumulated over the course of season 5. I've passed along your podcast suggestion to JV, and I have Fringe season 1 on DVD. I'm going to check it out as soon as I can because I want to try and get in sync with the new season when it starts soon. So stay tuned. There's a good chance we'll be getting to Fringe on the podcast. And finally, I would love to have Linda Moulton Howe back on the show. Trust me. I would say right now, obviously, since we've already taped all of season 5, it's going to have to happen in another season. But I'm willing to bet we will have LMH back on BOA Audio at some point in the future. I love talking to her. I had a great time during that interview, and it really generated a lot of buzz throughout the world of esoterica. So having her back on the program would be great. That brings up a whole nother issue, Mike. You've preempted another aspect here of these final episodes of season 5, and that is that it's time for guest suggestions from the VOA audio listeners. Now, I know I say this at the end of every season. People send in tons of guest suggestions. Some of the folks end up on the air in the following season. Some folks don't make it on the show. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't send in your guest suggestions. Even if you sent them in last season and we didn't get your guest on, send it to me again. Tell me you really want to hear from this guest, and I'll do my best to get him on the program. I'm already putting together the list here for season 6, and it's looking pretty cool. I'm bringing some old guests back. I'm bringing in some new folks for the program. It's going to be quite a mix of previous BOA audio guests, new guests, all kinds of different topics. So we're already putting all the ingredients together here for season 6, and now it's time for you, the BOA audio listeners, to add your spice of choice to season 6. You'll hear the contact information in just a moment. Allow me to thank Mike once again for the great email. I really appreciate the donation and the props about the program and the website. I know the BOA staff appreciates it as well. Next email is short and sweet. It comes from Billy in Aberdeen, Scotland. And he just says, love to listen to all your shows. Keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Billy. There's not much to say in response to that, but I wanted to include your email here at the end of the program because, as noted, you're writing all the way from Aberdeen, Scotland. I got to put together some kind of map here and get the pushpins in on all the different countries that have contacted us. Billy, you have planted the BOA Nation's flag in Scotland. Much appreciated, sir. International listeners, I know you're out there somewhere. Send me your correspondence, and we will definitely highlight it here at the end of the program. Third email in the batch comes from Russell, also short and sweet. Here's what he has to say. Please don't put anything more on about the fictional made-for-TV Lost series. It has nothing to do with UFOs, etc. Russell. I wrote Russell back. It sounds kind of harsh here, this email that he sent me, but he's a sweet guy, and he's cool, so it wasn't in a mean-spirited way. And I can understand his point of view. I know a lot of folks didn't tune in to the Lost Cast series finale, even though we included it as part of Season 5. The big reason was because it was a 5-guest showcase there as we closed the book on the Lost Cast, and quite frankly, just a shitload of work for me. So I had to, you know, table BOA audio for the week, and I didn't want to sort of let this one go and slip through the cracks. In addition to all that, it also sort of kicked off the podcast, which we've been doing now, and hopefully Russell doesn't mind that I'm doing the podcast. That way we can kind of keep the pop culture and esoteric separate here on the different BOA audio programs. So nonetheless, I don't expect to do another Lost episode of BOA audio anytime soon. I can assure you of that, Russell. But you never know what might come up in the future, and I'm not going to apologize for doing some non-paranormal shows every now and again. We can't do UFOs and Bigfoot and conspiracy theories every week. Sometimes there's a compelling story on the fringes of the esoteric that deserves discussion, and you're going to hear it on BOA audio. We're never going to shy away from those stories, folks, like our previous edition of the program here with Tim Donaghy. But I've heard your call loud and clear, Russell. Thank you for writing in. Don't worry, no more Lost episodes, but cover your ears. There may be some other pop culture episodes somewhere down the line in the future. I'm not going to ever close the book on that option. And finally, we got an email here from Bob, no hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. I just wanted to drop you a line and let you know that I've really been enjoying season 5 of Banal of America. The last two episodes on the Catholic Church and the deja vu phenomenon have been two of the best interviews so far. Your interviewing style of being friendly, open, and most of all, interested, makes for some of the best interviews I've ever heard, especially in the esoteric fields. I have to say I was not really interested in either topic before the shows, but I found both shows fascinating. Thanks for all you do. Keep up the good work. Bob. Thank you for writing in, Bob. Thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate them, and I really feel affirmed, I guess you could say, via your email. We've definitely gone off the beaten path here this season, although I think that was sort of the case over the last two seasons as well. I'm always open to the fringe of esoterica, as we just noted here for Russell's email, but especially stuff like, as you said, the Catholic Church situation and the deja vu phenomenon, as well as
the Santa Muerte episode from a couple of weeks ago. There's so much stuff out there, folks, in the world of esoterica that just does not get the headline status of UFOs, conspiracy theory, and cryptozoology, also ghost hunting, of course, that a lot of these stories and topics sometimes slip through the cracks. And my goal here with this program is to highlight those stories and bring some of those folks on the show to talk about their amazing research into stuff that chances are a lot of folks listening to the program have never really heard about or considered in the first place, kind of like what Bob is saying here. To tie that back around to Mike in Minneapolis's email, not only are we looking for guest suggestions for Season 6, we're also looking for topic suggestions in Season 6. So if you have the opportunity and you have the idea for something you want to hear us talk about, shoot me an email and we will definitely dig into it. And as I said, if you've emailed me before, don't hesitate to do it again if I didn't get back to you or if we didn't get your guest slash topic covered here in Season 5. We have limited slots. Scheduling can be difficult with some of these guests. And I will always be honest with you folks as far as what is going on with your requested guest slash topic. And on that note, thank you to Bob for writing in. Thank you to Russell for writing in, as well as Billy in Aberdeen, Scotland, and Mike in Minneapolis. All great BOA audio listeners all had something cool or interesting to say here at the end of the program. How do you get in touch with me? How can you vie for a spot in the final BOA audio listener feedback of the season? And how can you get in touch with me to request a guest or topic? That's simple. Here are the means of communication. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or just go to binalofamerica.com, binalofamerica.com, and click the contact button. Also, you can go to the official BOA forum, the usofe.com, theusofe.com. And, of course, as I've been noting here at the end of the show for a while, there are all the different social networking sites where you can find me, Twitter, MySpace, and Facebook. Just punch in Binal, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, befriend me, follow me, poke me, it's all good. And chances are you're going to get some cool inside nuggets via one of those social networking mediums. So those are all the methods. Trust me, I read all the correspondence I get. I try to write back to as many people as possible. Some emails slip through the cracks, but I like to think my record so far is at about 85 to 90%. Send me your feedback on the season as a whole or the last few episodes or anything you want to tell me, including thoughtful, constructive criticism. I can take it. I want your feedback, folks. And if it's particularly pithy or it hits on a topic I have been meaning to discuss here at the end of the show, it just may be included in the final BOA audio listener feedback segment of the season next week. Up next, of course, you know what it is. It is the thanks portion of the show. Allow me to roll through the list of the esteemed and infamous BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, our contributing cartoonist Andy Carolin, and our webmaster Jeremy Boston. Three new columns at BOA since the last time you heard from me. Marla Pena's Shadow of the Shinigami looks at the Crop Circle Enigma. Richard Thomas's Sci-Fi Worlds features an interview with author Lance Parkman. And Leslie's Gray Matters discusses the Manson family and why there seems to be a weird interest in that horrific crime and cult. We say it week in and week out here at the end of the program, but it is true, my friends. If you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at binalofamerica.com, then you're only getting half of the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. I alluded to it briefly a moment ago, but it is time for me to come at you with my hand held out, folks, and ask for donations to the program and to BOA in general. The bills have been piling up here in Season 5, and I would like to get us on an even keel here as we close the book on the fifth season of BOA Audio. And in order to do that, it would be great if I could get some help from the folks who've been enjoying the program over the last 9 months or so. How can you help us out? That's simple. There are two ways to donate. You can just go to binalofamerica.com and click the PayPal button. That's pretty easy to find. they'll walk you through the whole process. It's very simple and very secure. Maybe you don't trust the internet, maybe you don't trust those folks at PayPal, and you want to make a donation the old-fashioned way, via snail mail. Well, we can hook you up with that, folks, because we have a P.O. box waiting for your mailed-in donation. Here is the address. Tim Benall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass., 01866. Let me go through that very specifically for you. It's Tim Benall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T, Mass., 01866. So, all together now, it's Tim Benall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass., 01866. And, as always, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Benall of America and BOA Audio to help keep the website and the audio series up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. Next week on the program, it is the penultimate edition of BOA Audio Season 5, and we're welcoming another superstar esoteric researcher. This time around, it is Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and it is a wide-ranging jam session of an interview that covers just a myriad of paranormal topics. It would be virtually impossible for me to tell you all the different areas we cover, all the different avenues we go down. It's a very organic interview, and as I said, it is truly a jam session of the BOA mold. Rosemary Ellen Guiley not only has been in this field for almost 30 years or so, but she's also written over 40 books on just an amazing variety of esoteric topics. So there's so many different avenues we could have gone down in this conversation and did. So I'm really looking forward to people checking this one out. I really enjoyed it quite a bit. Despite the delay here in getting you episode 2 of the final 4, I'm going to work my ass off to get you episode 3 sooner than this one came at you. I know I've been saying that at the end of the show for the last few weeks, but this time I mean it. So stay tuned to Benall of America for that coming at you, hopefully sooner rather than later. Plus, as an added bonus, at the end of the show, we're going to have a pop-in from our old friend Peter Robbins. He's going to preview the upcoming Exeter UFO Festival, where he will be making a pair of presentations, and I will be serving as MC. Of course, you can find out more about that at ExeterUFOFestival.com. Hope to see a lot of BOA Audio listeners in attendance. And on that note, we say goodbye here at the end of another edition of BOA Audio Season 5. Big, super huge thanks once again to Dr. Bruce Maccabee. It was a real thrill to have him on the show. Big thanks to Mike in Minneapolis, Billy in Aberdeen, Scotland, Russell, and Bob for writing in on BOA Audio listener feedback. And finally, of course, big thanks to all you great listeners out there. Thank you for your patience with this program. Thank you for sticking with BOA Audio and not just listening to the program, but writing in and supporting the show, making donations, and spreading the word about our creepy little esoteric podcast. I can't thank you enough, folks. You are the real voice of this program, and you are the fuel that drives the machine. Thank you so much for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. And until next time, this is Tim Benall, thanking you for listening and signing off.